ask the public about health, they put the responsibility on the individual, then point to the NHS to help out. And yet we know the context in which we live and make choices really matters. The context that governments, businesses, employers and investors have a big hand in shaping. The pandemic may have shifted things. Polling shows the public now sees the government as having an important role in improving people's health. About 80% of us think that, particularly on smoking and alcohol. And there's public appetite to reduce inequalities in health in between different groups shown up by the pandemic. Meantime, we await the government's forthcoming public health strategy. But the strong instinct of the current government is already revealed, not to nanny and intervene, instead rely on individuals to take control. We saw the government recently row back on plans to ban bog-offs, that's buy one, get one free junk food promotions. Yet the evidence is overwhelming that relying on individual choice just won't dent the current alarming trends on obesity. So, how to make progress? In today's podcast, we'll be exploring if public opinion can be moved to spur the government to act more on health. With me today to discuss, I'm pleased to welcome Jackie Dyer, who is the co-founder and CEO of Black Thrive Global, a community interest company established in 2016 to address the inequalities affecting mental health and well-being of Black people in Lambeth. Among many other things, she's also a local councillor in Lambeth. And John Hume, who's the chief executive of the People's Health Trust, a charity focused on reducing health inequalities through community development. He's also a proud Northerner who's lived in the South for 25 years. Welcome both. So our recent work seems to show that the public believe that the onus on staying healthy is on the individual. And when you get sick, it's a matter for the NHS. And I was wanting to ask you both, given the communities you work with, is that your understanding and experience of the people you're working with, that it's really your own responsibility? You're on your own, really. It's not really government's responsibility or business to shape things.
I think that there's many ways of looking at this, but for me, it's very difficult in a sort of the past couple of decades to really, especially some of the communities that I work with, which are some of the most deprived communities, communities that are vulnerable, that experience vulnerabilities. It's very difficult when you're in a state of poor health or developing some ailment to think about something else being the source of that problem.
Yeah.
And I think that the way that society has sort of developed over the past few decades, where actually the position that you're in, your socioeconomic position, for example, and we know that the social determinants have a significant role to play in one's health. The way that society has developed over the past couple decades means that you think that it's your individual responsibility for your health status, where I would argue strongly against that, whilst I think that there is individual responsibility to do things to actively take care of yourself. Some of the source of those issues actually emerge from your employment situation, your education situation, your housing situation, your access to opportunities that might allow you to have a reasonable income for yourself and your family and your loved ones in order to eat properly.
Yeah.
To exercise properly. When you're under stress and strain, those choices kind of get minimized. I think that the way that society has gone from being one which is around really about communities or society to one where it's more individualistic gives people the impression that it's only about individual responsibility. And I counter that.
The communities that you represent and actually work a lot with through your role as councillor, Jackie, and also in Black Thrive, if you were to assess their opinion on that, how far health is down to them as opposed to wider forces, what would you say?
I think some of my communities are very much aware of the systemic discrimination and systemic oppression that they are living through, and would source some of that impact on their health, particularly in the context of mental health.
Yeah.
source that on systemic racism and systemic discrimination. It's different for different communities. And it's quite difficult, as I said, to think about when you're actually in that state of unwellness, you're not necessarily going to ascertain, oh, that's the source of some policies are the source of my distress.
Yeah.
So I think it's different for different people. Some would say, yes, of course, it's my own problem that I've got to resolve. And others would take a different view depending on how much they understood the context and its impact, the environment and its impact on their everyday lives.
And John, how would you respond to this question?
I would say that with the communities that we work with, their initial response to what health means would almost certainly always be about the NHS.
Yeah.
And about major diseases. And truthfully, things that are readily produced as stories, you know, across the media and that are therefore consumed by the public, you know, a rate of knots across social media as well. Yeah. But I think that once you're clear that what you don't mean are the major killers and you don't mean the NHS, and once those communities feel really confident that actually what you're not doing is judging them, I think they really quickly open up. And this is, you know, I think it's particularly the case for communities that have got significant disadvantage where class, race, you know, material disadvantage is a factor. I think you rarely get people talking about health in a way which is about disease. They might start off about that, but really what they start to talk about is the housing, the lack of jobs, the low pay. Yeah. And they talk about, you know, people being in poorer schools or no places for their kids to play, and really often about bygone industry which hasn't been replaced. They understand, I think, that there's a connection between these dimensions of life and the impact on their health, because it's as old as the hills. And you know, and I think there's lots of examples of that, of, you know, people experiencing poverty. I think for generations, truthfully, have talked about the impact of stress from living conditions. Yeah. and how those impact their health and how that includes discrimination. There are communities that are, we work with people in the bottom 30% in terms of indices of multiple deprivation. So, you know, you're talking about some of the poorest communities in the country.
We commissioned some work from a group called Frameworks Institute last year, and they asked the public, focus groups, surveys, all sorts of work to get underneath opinion. And the opinion, at least on the face of it, was very strongly that it's the individual, it's my fault. It was kind of almost a blame. It's my fault if I'm ill kind of thing. It was quite a prevalent finding. And some of the researchers were sort of mooting whether or not this is almost about a desire for more control, that a kind of belief that things are down to you and your choices can perversely be quite comforting, because it means that you've got control. And I know, we know there's a sort of take back control meme in some communities, isn't there? And I wondered whether you felt that there was something in that.
Yes, I mean, I do think there's something in that kind of freedom to choose argument, you know, the idea that the state shouldn't be intervening too much on people's lives and choices, etc. But, you know, the truth is the state already does that in so many ways, and in so many ways that are really good for people, you know, whether it's about telling people they can't work X number of hours without a break, or, you know, wearing seatbelts. There are vast numbers of ways in which the state intervenes, which have vastly improved population health. But I'd kind of counter it by saying that I think talking about individual control is just easier. It's simpler for government, it's simpler for the media, it's simpler for people to understand, because the complexity of the issues, when you're talking about things with multiple causes, it's really hard, you know, that multi-causation thing. The idea that obesity is not just about what people choose to eat or whether they choose to exercise, but it's actually about policy decisions and regulations and trade deals and free markets and poverty and, you know, and even town planning. All of those things are difficult. So I think the issues, to me, feels like it's more about one is controllable and understandable, which is the individual thing. I can do something. And the other one is unfathomable. You know, it's too large. It's overwhelming. There's those elements to it. And that's without bringing in the kind of the other side of it, which is about the stigma that people experience in poor communities. That sort of feckless, shirking, poor idea, you know, that it's still prevalent. It's very much there.
And Jackie, I mean, you were saying earlier that you thought that people felt that things might be within their control if they were ill, because that's what they were focusing on, their own individual health. But do you see some sort of benefit to thinking about health for individuals, that it is under their control? Do you see a trend in your communities to think that or not?
I actually agree with the sense of what can I do? Yes. So a sense of your own agency in taking care of yourself, the underlying reasons as to whether or not you might feel confident enough to do that for whatever reasons is another question. But for sure, people would want the agency to be able to say, I can lead my life in a way that is healthy, and I would really like to do that. The question then is the how and the access to be able to enable that to materialize. And that's now when you start encountering the limitations of your opportunities to be able to have the best possible healthy life, because a lot of it is resource dependent.
Yeah.
Many of the communities that are most impacted, especially I would say non-white communities, it's much more of a struggle to do so. And then you're challenged with the shame of not being able to improve your health, which acts, I suppose that's what John is saying about stigma, because you start believing that it's purely about you. So it's very complicated and it gets distorted. So when you separate, or that it's just about yourself making a choice, you know, individual responsibility, that's a naive way of presenting it, because it doesn't take into consideration the other factors that determine how an access to better health outcomes. You can't do it in isolation.
Yeah. Also, polling within the pandemic showed that public attitudes did shift in terms of thinking how far governments had agency to protect our health. I mean, for obvious reasons, not just to say that government has a role, a big role in securing public health, but also there was concern and appetite amongst the public to address inequalities in health. Is that going to stick or is it not?
I think it's really quite important to think about the complexities, because there's national sort of role that government plays in terms of policies to support having a healthier population, which I think is their responsibility. But there's also on a regional level around what can be done regionally and leadership shown around supporting a more healthier population and what can be done locally. And so we start thinking about the workplace, we start thinking about employers, we start thinking about access to green spaces, access to better housing, access to all those other things that at each different level of our society, an investment and better attention to would help to alleviate some of the risk factors that create poorer health outcomes for communities, particularly if they lived in deprived areas. And I would then say, how does local stakeholders, regional stakeholders, work with those populations that are experiencing the worst outcomes to address the inequalities and the inequities in their whole life experiences that lead to these poorer outcomes? So there's activation that's required at different levels and a really different way of addressing the population's health than what has sort of like been invested in previously.
John, I was just looking at some of the films on your website of the communities that you've worked with at the People's Health Trust. I was thinking of the community in Wales, in Birmingham, and in Liverpool in particular. I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about how those communities have been raised into greater consciousness, in a sense of how they can collectively work to improve the health of the community.
Yeah, I mean, we've got some long-term funding in some areas, which has been the key to it, I think. In some places, we've funded for 10 years because it takes that amount of time to start to be trusted and start and helping things to move. So up in Gateshead, we've got a particularly good area in Edwards House, a community which is in the bottom 10% in IMD, largely ignored, I've got to say, for many, many years. And it really started with people determining what health meant to them. So when we went in and did a year with them of saying, what does health mean to you? The things they came up with weren't about the NHS or sickness. They were employability, money management, the local health, and then bringing the community together. Those were the things that they felt were the most health protective things that they could have. And that meant we built activity around them. And this moved into them getting partnership with the statutory services you know, and started to understand the language that was required with those services, and also started to have in the theory of change, there was the idea that they built up knowledge, but they also built up confidence and a sense of what they wanted to achieve as a community. So they became a place for statutory services to work with, and also that they were unable to ignore. And that meant that that places started to offer fewer top-down ideas. And they came up with a community linking project, which was working with the GP services, not social prescribing, but just having this linking worker in there for things where people turned up with which were non-biomedical, where they knew that actually what they needed to do was to be working elsewhere. They didn't need to be medicalized for what was going on, and it was actually debt management they needed. That project, which we part funded with government, ended up being evaluated and has now been rolled out to something like 25, 30 different GPs across the area because it was so successful. And they're now part of a system. What started off as a small group, you know, I'm talking about a group with a turnover of about, you know, £30,000, has ended up getting multiple grants. It's working with the local authority, with the PCNs, with the ICS. It's now part of developing those system-wide plans for their neighbourhood. But what they've learned is, you know, what the statutory services have learned is that local people have got huge amounts of skill, knowledge, wisdom that they're now being able to apply. And it's starting to pay dividends, but it is focusing on the social determinants of health. It plays into this idea that, you know, Michael Marmot said once, which was, you can't treat people and return them to the conditions that they came from and hope things will get better. It's just madness. And it is. And I think there you start to see things turn around quite significantly in that neighbourhood.
Yeah. And Jackie, are you seeing this type of, I mean, it sounds like old-fashioned community development, this to me, doesn't it? Do you see neighbourhood groups working in the same way in Lambeth?
So if I focus on the Black Thrive partnership, that is a partnership between system stakeholders, i.e. the local authority is the lead, the Mental Health Trust, the police, and Black-led community organisations to identify the areas across the life course which need attention in order to improve the Black, and I mean the Black experience. So if you think, for example, in Lambeth, if you are Black, you are 13 times more likely to be in temporary accommodation. Your likelihood as a young person, a child, to be excluded from school is high. You are likely to find yourself in inpatient and secure mental health services to a much greater degree than your white counterparts. These are reflections of deeply embedded structural racism. And so on one level, some of the work that we're doing is similar to what John speaks to. But the other work that we're attending to is actually that systemic racism that means that you have to pay attention to those particular barriers and obstacles that an anti-Black system puts in the way. So it's not one size fits all. It's actually dealing with the differential experience that you have as a Black body in terms of access to employment. We've got a male population that 50% are unemployed, 50% employed. We've got a white population, white male population, where the figures are more like 90% employed. These are figures that have been present for several decades. And if you actually ride on one bus from one part of Lambeth to the other part of Lambeth, a vast majority of what you will see is so visible in terms of Black poverty because they have nowhere else to go and they are literally in groups right along that journey from the north of the borough to the south of the borough. We have to pay deeper attention to these things that create poor mental health outcomes and poor lives.
And are you seeing, Jackie, the kinds of community development that John is describing that can help tilt some of it? I mean, it can't tilt the balance of very deep-seated issues that may require a sort of national intervention, but there's certainly a lot of good that can be done locally. So are you seeing local groups sort of becoming more empowered in the way that John is describing? And is that tilting the balance locally at all, in your view?
I think it's a big tilt and it takes time. So I think the short term answer is yes, we're having community groups much more engaged in helping us to shape the interventions or the support that they require, because they are co-producing, they are involved in identifying what the response needs to be in order to support them. So, for example, accessing peer support and culturally appropriate advocacy is a service that's been co-designed with communities to give them the support that they actually need when they're experiencing that kind of vulnerability. And so that helps to change the narrative around how services kind of manifest, that they can be better at meeting the needs of diverse populations because those diverse populations are helping to shape them. And so, and I think that that's really something that's been catalyzed even further as a result of COVID, because we've got loads of neighborhood level community groups that are eager to work with us as our local authority in helping to shape what their neighborhoods need to be like in order to keep them healthy.
Jennifer, can I just come in on that? Because I think what it does is it's exactly what I think Jackie is describing. It sort of shifts the mood. It makes people pay attention. And there are some great examples of it then that can get used as ways in which you can do meaningful, really meaningful community involvement, not consultation, but really meaningful involvement. You know, however, it does only go so far, and it does require significant local, national government, business. You know, it needs other voluntary community sector organisations, because they're not all good at this as well.
If you think of the waves of challenge that are ahead, well, not just with the cost of living, but the economy and, you know, what might happen to communities. And then you see in here the fabulous work you've both described at local level. Presumably it's got to be a patchwork here, because there just aren't enough community development groups or charities to go around. How do you boost this type of activity? Is it, as you say, John, to coordinate a bit more with the voluntary sector and with local government?
It's difficult, isn't it? There's the call for the Community Act, which is a call for a stronger role for voluntary and community sector organisations, really in developing and delivering some of those public services, yeah. And therefore creating stronger local accountability. But it's rooted in things that are pragmatic, you know, things that people really want to do, but that will kind of mean that you're part of a system. But I think there's also got to be, what I think we're really, really bad at is just pulling together enough of that evidence as well that, you know, this is not just about problems. How many times do we have to reframe the same problem over and over again? And when are we going to start kind of really talking about there are some solutions here, and these are not just about individuals, but they're about population level changes, and those need to involve businesses, and they need to involve other organisations, anchor organisations and institutions and governments making some of those decisions. And there has to be an economic argument behind that, you know, that it actually is economically does not make sense to continue to do what we do. You know, you can't have the chief executive of the NHS saying the NHS is at winter level pressures. I mean, that doesn't make sense at this point in June. It's, you know, we can't continue like this. So I think, you know, There's a need to galvanise funders behind this, so that funders are funding all of those local organisations. There feels like a need for stronger legislation to allow local organisations to be able to take on some of this role. But most of all, I think the thing to me that is really going to start shifting the dial on this is there needs to be a much wider public awareness that what healthy life expectancy and life expectancy really means. That's a big communication piece, which I know the Health Foundation, Jennifer's doing and leading on, which is fantastic. What health really means are all of these things in the system that affect us, this discrimination, the unemployment, the kind of lack of green spaces, etc. As long as the public's not saying that, it's the perfect opportunity to reach for the low-hanging fruit and not fund a systemic approach to this, which involves voluntary community sectors as well.
Yeah, Jackie.
I suppose I'm saying that similar to you, is that there are actors at different levels, national, regional, local. So if we think on a local level, local government have a key coordinating role to play on this and have within their portfolio, a range of levers to be able to assist that agenda. And that's what we're doing. So I lead on inclusive economies and equalities. So what that means to me is taking a very systematic approach and systemic approach to our equality, diversity, inclusion agenda, which is really essentially about improving health and well-being of our population and threading that into every aspect of what it is that we do as a local authority. So pulling on all those levers that we've got available to us. And then the expectation that all our partners, all the stakeholders that engage with us, they have health equity right at the center of their negotiations and their engagement. And the highest possible standard of commitment to the population where we are located is infused through the work that they do with us. And that pulls in the voluntary sector, the community sector, the populations that we serve to be able to help to shape what that looks like and actually really identify what their needs are in order for everybody to thrive and flourish within a local kind of economy. So I also, so that pulls in the anchor, the big employers like the local mental health trust, the primary care networks, the small and medium-sized businesses, the larger businesses, where it's this expectation that actually we want all parts of our communities to flourish. What are you going to do in relation to contributing to what it is that they're asking of you? It's about ongoing community involvement and community engagement, changing the sort of power imbalance so that the voice of our populations that we're serving become much more influential in shaping where the public purse is spent. Because one of my concerns is always that we can ask for more from voluntary sector and community groups, but actually the resource isn't going in that direction. So we need to change some of that imbalance in terms of the resource flows.
Yeah. So, Jackie, you're a councillor and you'll know more than anyone about the resource squeeze going on. And I get quite a few emails in my job where people are asking, you know, voluntary sector groups are just saying we can't, everybody, all the local authorities want to have evidence shown about the impact of what we're trying to do. And if you think about the wider determinants, it's really, really difficult to show. Yeah. And you need long-term studies which are fiendishly expensive. So how do we get over this issue where it's kind of obvious, isn't it, that if you empower people, if you help them in the type of projects you've described and John has described in Gateshead and Liverpool, Wales, how do we get beyond this sort of need for hard evidence? Because we're not going to be able to unlock resources otherwise, are we? And how do we describe the complexity to give trust and cover to people who are trying to give resources to these communities?
It's quite an interesting thing, isn't it? Because in some ways, I don't think the responsibility and the burden for collecting evidence can sit at the very local level. One, because Jennifer, it's just too costly, it's too difficult. It will consume organisations. But I'm just wondering, kind of, sometimes I think, where are the measures at kind of the really good local authority measures and the government measures? So we see endless measures about people, individuals, weight, alcohol intake, tobacco consumption, etc. But you don't see measures which are, you know, about a commitment to the Treasury in terms of health benefiting fiscal policies, do you? Or, you know, commitments on, you know, very specific, hard commitments on housing. But I think there's some emerging examples. I don't know if you've seen the stuff that the Institute for Health Equity's done with Jessica Allen and Michael Marmot around Greater Manchester, but I think their Build Back Fairer recommendations, which work across, you know, like a number of dimensions, but for the first time they've also put these kind of beacons in, so these indicators of success, which is going to point to some data. It's going to demonstrate, you know, just as the Coventry as a Marmot city was able to use proxies of, you know, things such as they were able to use I think they increased by 4% fewer neighborhoods were in the 10% most deprived as a result of 5 years of a very concerted effort on working on the social determinants of health. Well, I mean, that's quite a phenomenal figure, that's quite a phenomenal shift, and I think it's that kind of level that we need because that's where the case is going to be made. Because otherwise, I think it's just too easy for everyone to dismiss, well, it was the right place, the right people, the right set of circumstances. And truthfully, that is the case. A lot of that, when it works hyperlocally, is down to serendipity. It's not a system-wide piece. So I think if we're going to evaluate, we first need to have those really good targets set at government level, which are absent from a lot of policies, I'm afraid. And then, or if they are there, they're unrealistic. So I feel like we need to have that good targets at the national level that can be then rolled out locally. But we can draw on this extensive work the Institute of Health Equity started to do around this and around ways to measure it that are not overly onerous, because those local authorities in those places that you're working in, Jackie, will already be measuring. So you're asking people just to focus it in on a different way. And then the VCS organisations can feed into that. Why not?
So, Jackie, how does Lambeth, you get multiple requests for funding across the wider determinants piece, say, given the fact you can't measure the impact, the possible impact that, you know, these little groups that are coming to you for funding will have, how do you then adjudicate?
There is an example of one of the ways that we've created a pot of resource that enables smaller community groups to access, and that aligns with what our borough plan sort of ambitions are. And that is a pot around social value. So how are you contributing to the social value of our local population? And not some big onerous sort of way of assessing that, but something which is quite simple and accessible. So that's one of the ways that we've been able to channel more resource into our community and voluntary sector. I would also add that we need to value more what our local communities, what our local populations identify as their indicators or their measures as what constitutes well-being, and find ways to honour that so that then you have a combination of what measures are important to our communities. And that kind of helps to pick up some of the inequities and the diversity experience piece, as well as things that are sort of on a more national and regional kind of a direction. How many anchor institutions like Mental Health Trust, NHS, Acute Trust are using that social value mechanism in order to give back in an almost corporate social responsibility way back to our communities? Because surely part of the agenda here has to be, how do we move from a kind of pipeline of people ending up in crisis, one which is more earlier intervention and prevention, and so that the resource flows end up coming back or build upon the resilience of our communities? How do we use our resource flows, our public purse, in a much more intentional way that benefits the health of our population, not just in crisis?
I think we just need all of us to be a bit cautious about is the kind of concept that well-being could change and improve for people. I think you just mentioned that then, Jackie, and I think one of the dangers is, and I know you'll know this because you'll be working in this as well as we do, but one of the unintended consequences of some of our research was that well-being in some of the neighbourhoods we're working in has increased significantly. I mean, you're talking, you know, tens of percentage points increase compared to similar neighbourhoods experiencing similar levels of disadvantage, but actually the health inequalities have widened. So, and there's a real danger there that actually what we need to do and what we need to create and how we need to balance these things out can't mask what is the fundamental problem, because people don't notice health inequalities widening when you're getting a change of 0.3 years of life. People don't notice that, but they do notice that they might feel better because there are more community groups, there's more going on, you've got more of a collectivity going on. And it's a downside of this, of the whole of that kind of community development work, that you could actually be starting to mask a problem.
What I've heard, and I will just come to you for a last comment on this, is it's some big messages here. So you've stressed, I think, the most important thing is to engage local people and trust their views as to what they are saying to improve health. The second is to have a wider group of people and assets, voluntary sector, businesses, local government, to act in concert on the wider determinants of health. The third, to have a local vision or regional vision on health, what it takes to have a healthy life that people can buy into in order to act in concert. And fourthly, to have some sort of longer term sort of effort rather than piecemeal, every 2 years change. Is that the sort of summary, or is there anything that either of you would add that is coming out of this?
That's really helpful. And that when I think of what you've just said, I think to myself, oh my goodness. And that's really what's embedded in, I call Leave Thrive London. And actually that's what's really embedded in our vision for public mental health across London. So yes, John.
Yeah, I would say that my key thing is that we need to get this message out much stronger across to the public so that people really understand, because that I think in turn will influence government, that what health is about is not about the big killers in the NHS. That's a sickness service. It's not the right thing. The only other things I'd add into that is that I think there needs to be much, much stronger cross-departmental government working, possibly with the implementation of something like health inequalities into the Green Book, like, you know, Nancy Hay and the What Works for Wellbeing Centre did, which is a phenomenal piece of work, and what difference that could make. There needs to be that kind of policies piece linked to investment. We've got so many strategies, we don't really have any policies to implement them, and certainly not much investment to implement some of them either. And I think if you can link that to real life examples, you know, in housing and living wage, etc., that can actually work, I think there is an opportunity now, because I think, as you said, Jennifer, the public's opinion is changing slightly on this. And it's an opportunity to take and to run with, I think.
That's a great place to end. Thank you both very, very much. So that was really interesting. Thank you very much to Jackie and John for great insights from their work with the communities they work with. All much appreciated. We've referred to several publications in this podcast. For example, A Matter of Life and Death, which was published by us of the work by the Frameworks Institute. You might want to take a look. In July, we'll be publishing a toolkit, which is a follow-up, which will try to help people working with the public to frame discussions better on health to unlock action on the wider determinants. And we'll also put in the show notes links to our work on anchor institutions that was referred to by Jackie and John in this podcast. So next month, we'll return to healthcare, comparing the NHS to the German system. I'll be talking to the chief executives managing two leading academic teaching hospitals, the Charité in Berlin, Germany's largest hospital, and Imperial College Healthcare NHS Trust. So that is going to be very interesting, given the extra resources that the Germans have in their system. And there'll be fruity comparisons, no doubt. Anyway, all that's lined up. See you then next month, and stay well until then.